Yeah, I would agree that I think there are moments when you're trying to come to terms with, when you are trying to get to the sort of a complicated acceptance that isn't, as you
Right.
say, in that sort of banal, sort of almost Hallmark sort of way. But again, there's a lot of language that's sort of very direct. I'm even thinking at the beginning when you go to see your mother, and there just seemed like something that was very direct in your descriptions of it, of everything. Which I liked a lot, and I actually felt like the language itself was doing what the essay was trying, sort of emotionally, intellectually, to do, that the language was struggling with that too, and I thought that's why it was so stunning, really.
As you say that, it occurs to me that when I began writing, I really thought of myself as a lyric poet. I was after the moment, the lyric moment. And over time, and I mean, and that phrase, over time, is important to this. Over time, I feel like I've been less and less after the moment, because the longer you stay alive, the more interesting the medium of time becomes. Things change, people change in time. I'm not so as interested in this sort of high lyric moment as I once was. There are a number of books that made me want to write prose, and one of them was Edmund White's Nocturnes for the King of Naples, which is so lyrical, most people bounce right off it. I can't figure out a word of what it's saying. I worship that novel. I went back and read it about 6 or 7 years ago, and I realized I still loved the novel, but I didn't worship it. Having come through the experience of many friends' death and what it's meant to be in a hospital a lot with AIDS for other people or with liver disease for myself, having had to learn what it is to sort of like get someone's attention to go, you get me that glass of water or I get you fired. That lyricism didn't seem so valuable as it once did. To me, the place where I sort of most questioned lyricism, oddly, not oddly, or challenged, I felt was in Ghost Letters, where although there's a number of lyrical poems, there's a lot in there that is really, in my mind, sort of poised against the idea that putting something in language is about its lyric lifting and its transcendence. And I began to feel very distrustful of language like that. Some of the poems that began to speak to me and works began to speak to me were actually things that were plainer. I think of Marie Howe's book, What the Living Do, a book I really love. And she has such an extraordinary gift for a kind of delicacy and hardness and clarity all at the same time. One time I was walking down the street in Provincetown with Tony Hoagland and Mark Doty and Marie Howe and someone else, and Tony said something about, it was starting to snow, that was it. And Tony said something like, oh, Mark, I know how you would see the snow. And Mark said, how? And Tony said, as a beautiful transcendence, as a kind of, so on, metaphoric aspect. And Mark said, yes. And he said, Richard, and you would see it like, and in fact, I don't remember how he told me I would see it, maybe I don't wish to remember how I would see it. But then Marie said, what about me? How would I see the snow? And Tony turned to her and he said, as snow. You're the only one who sees snow. And I thought, oh, right. And I thought that was a really great lesson for me as a writer, to realize Marie was seeing snow.
That sort of reminds me, and I'm not going to remember this exactly either. In Nights of 1990, the opening poem, long poem in Ghost Letters, where at some point someone comes into the room. I can't remember if it's the nurse or if it's a chaplain or somebody, and she says something like, "A miracle is happening in this room," or something mysterious has happened in this room, and you think, in this room, in this horrible. So there's
I think
this
he says
kind
in this lime green
of,
room,
right.
right?
There are those oppositions in that book where some of it is, I think, really sublimely lyrical, but you are constantly sort of not even so much pushing. I feel like you're sometimes really crashing against that sometimes because you don't want to fall into the trap of the gauze, maybe.
I hope so. And you had brought this up as a question of tone. Ultimately, what is tone? And it seems to me more and more that tone is actually about juxtaposition of diction and juxtaposition of voices. The tone is derived not from finding a note, but from actually smashing different kinds of notes together. So that, for instance, ironic high fag talk is often at once really street argot and spoken like a real lady. Probably the first prose writer I loved avidly. I had loved dramatists before. That was probably Jean Genet, whom I started reading in high school. And when one looks at him, he is a master of taking like eight different kinds of tone and throwing them together into a small space and creating something that is at once so sacramental and so base. And I've always loved that, you know, that combination.
I do see Ghost Letters as a kind of dance between physical desire and death. There's a lot of sex in there. It's very, very explicit, some very explicit stuff. And in Mother, not so much, you know, there isn't so much. I mean, the sort of one story, I'm not going to remember the title now, Medina.
Oh, Some Threads Through the Medina.
Some Threads
That's
Through
an
Medina.
Almost sex story.
That's an almost sex never story. Happens. And that's about sort of as close as it gets. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts about why that might be so. I mean, there's all sorts of ardor and passionate desire in that book. I mean, yeah. Even in Threads Through Medina, but it's not of the physical time, and not in the way that it is in Ghost Letters. That's what made me think of it.
That's a great question. I don't know the answer. I can only say that maybe it was more possible to write of sex, and specifically of anonymous sex in Ghost Letters. I think that's probably the kind right. that's most often limbed, if I may use the word, in Ghost Letters. Maybe because, in fact, it was going to be short, you know, because they mm-hmm. were poems. Maybe because in a poem, you know, you're making contact with your material in a very intense, but not long way, the way you do in prose. You know, in prose, I mean, if you're going to write about something, you have to live with it for like weeks and weeks and weeks to do a scene. I've never really tried to live with writing sex for weeks and weeks and weeks. I think the obvious thing would be to say is that aside from gossiping and... Well, speaking of it in certain gossipy kinds of ways, even with you about ourselves, I'm comfortable talking about sex like that, but feel like writing about it, oh my goodness. You know, you have to come to something with such authenticity, in my eyes, to write about it, and I hardly know how to begin.
It's tough. I mean, because you have to be writing about... It's not interesting unless you're really writing about something else, unless you're really describing something else. So... You know, I mean, I think that is what's interesting about Some Threads through Medina.
That guy, I kind of like him. He was really kind of, I feel like a lot of what he says, his narration in there, is touched by a kind of old-style homosexual speaking, you know. There's a kind of elaborateness, there's a kind of decorum. You know, when he uses, like, four-letter words and stuff, he backs away from them. There's a kind of decorousness, you know, that is in his speech. It's right up against his longing, and above all, his actually really frank longing, and his lonesomeness. You know, I really enjoyed working on that story because I enjoyed being able to sort of access a sort of idea of a slight touch of a homosexual voice that I think no longer exists. You know, the decorous, regretful, slightly, you know, use language to push experience slightly back a bit because it could be harmed, kind of thing. As to why it doesn't appear much in other stories, well, a lot of them are set in childhood. Goodness knows I wouldn't want to be unseemly. You know, but I think maybe ultimately it's the longing that I'm most interested in describing.
It's a longing of a different sort. I do think of Mother of Sorrows as a love story. She does seem like certainly one of the great loves of the narrator's life, and that love is nourishing. It does help to create him, and I think that it helped to create a certain sensitivity and an appreciation for beauty and for something that's, you know, large when you talk about the sort of mm-hmm. self-mythologizing yeah. we do. And so I feel like the love gives him all sorts of things, and it's also, it's damaging. I mean, it's sort of, you know, going back to the image we were using, it's the trap, and it's also, I think, is the way to break free of the trap. I was wondering what, not that you would have a final take, but what your take on that relationship, did it change over the course of writing the book?
Very much. I do think it's a love story, and I probably had not thought of it with a mother and a son. I had not thought of it that way for a long time when I began. I think, first of all, how ultimately embarrassing, you know, gay man loves mother. You know, I mean, excuse me, where's the reinvention of a narrative there? Is that not the most primitive, sort of like sitting in ninth grade reading about what homosexuality is, a man who loves his mother? So it was humiliating to me that was my story, and I didn't really want to tell it. And you are one of the few people, very few people had ever read this manuscript in its entirety, if I can use that word, in its jumbled entirety before I finished it. You were one of the few who read many different pages that were supposed to be in entirety. I remember you saying, well, this should end with a wedding. You know, it should end with the mother remarrying as she does. And I thought, what a brilliant idea, you know. And it doesn't end like that, you know, it wasn't how it went. But I remember when you said that, thinking, yes, of course, because it's a love story, and it's not a happy one. It's an unhappy love story. The mother and son don't marry. Well, that is, of course, the unhappy and the happy ending, isn't it? The mother and son don't marry.
Yes,
you know?
It is.
And what a relief, and what a tragedy, you know, because they are, for each other, objects of real longing. I suppose the mother creates the son to fulfill her, and the son, in turn, never feels real or whole without her. And so he can't live without her because he doesn't feel whole, and yet in order to live on his own, he's got to repudiate her. It's built also into mothers and sons. You know, I always remember Audrey Emmerich saying in her book, Through Woman Born, a book about motherhood as an experience and institution, saying that there comes a time in the life of the boy when he must repudiate the feminine and the female both. And that's very sad. And I wanted to get at that sadness in Mother of Sorrows, the sadness of having to repudiate. But I think there's also a necessity to repudiate. It's not just it's not a gender necessity. It's not a necessity created by masculine must repudiate feminine. But in fact, that boy in that book, he does have to get angry at her, you know, in order to claim himself. I don't have a final take on that. I don't at all. Sometimes this mother and this son are based on a mother and son I know, you know, my mother and me. They're not us exactly, but, you know, there's a lot of overlap here and there. Well, I think sometimes, well, now you've done what you needed to do in life. You know, you've written about that relationship, which was so primary to me. Other times I think, what a stupid idea that you think it's over. You've never written about your mother when she was very old, for instance, in a nursing home. And I think, oh yeah, not over at all. So I have no final take. I don't really have an urge to have a final take. I do have an urge, and I hope I've enacted an urge, to present a complicated rendering of a very complicated relationship that I myself wouldn't know how to resolve. Maybe that's why the book doesn't end with a wedding.
I will say that I do like this. I like the sequence now, and I was actually thinking about this on the way up today, because there is sort of a lot of the lyrical stuff, and then there's the last two are, if I'm right, are My Brother in the Basement, and then the Universe Concealed. And so it sort of ends, I think, with the more of this sort of anger toward the mother, and, yeah, and an acknowledgement of the damage in the penultimate story. And then the final story is really this narrator making a life away from her.
Yes,
you know,
that's right.
And making a life with friends and having to reconfigure or reinvent family. And so the love story sort of does end, and he does so. I like that. I like the sequence of it a lot. I mean, I like the arc of that a lot.
I'm glad to meet, you know, the mother appears in that last story, but she appears in recollection only as having been in a nursing home and is now being dead, which my mother wasn't when I started that story, but she now is. I didn't want it, but when I assembled the stories, I thought I really did like this idea of closing with his having... The story is about an effort to make a home, and he does and does not make a home for himself, you know? And in that way, it is about an effort to found a family that doesn't look anything like the family he was raised in. It's him and a gay man and a straight woman friend, and they're both of them out flirting with others and drawn back together in grief. But it is a bond, a very strong bond. And I thought it was the place where he actually steps out, and he is actually living on his own, not so much fully in relation, whether in relation of longing or relation of anger, to the mother.
It seems like the perfect ending for the book to me. Everybody who's ever met you knows that you're one of the funniest people alive, and everybody says that, but you don't
That's
use that
killer.
as a you don't use that as a strategy in your art. My Brother in the Basement, that does have sort of some funny kind of cutting stuff in it. I'd like you to talk about that. Like, is that conscious, or is it are you just not thinking of that? Or,
oh, it's not conscious. It's not conscious. I'm aware of what you're talking about. I do think that there are. I looks like I'm pleading. You know, like I do think there are some funny bits. You know,
there are some funny bits.
Like
when you say in this horrible lime green room. I mean, there is something painful and funny about that moment. I think the pain overrides the humor of it.
Yeah, I think in The Universe Concealed, there's probably, that's where there are the most jokes, and that's also to me, one of the most painful stories. What I tried to do in that story, and in that story more than any other, I was aware of wanting to use humor, black mm-hmm. humor, but humor. And I wanted to get at that more than I'd ever been able to or had let myself. That's a complicated arena for me. You know, first of all, it thrills me to think that everyone who's met me thinks I'm hilarious. But second, you know, a lot of humor, for me in any case, is defensiveness. There's very little I like quite so much as sort of like enacting a self who's not quite me and parading around, you know. It's thrilling, you know. It's enlivening, you know. I feel so alert, you know. Writing has been an effort to get underneath my own defense systems, you know. That's the strength of my work. It would also be a strength to do something more that I have not been able to do, I sometimes think, which is to use my defense systems more in my work and to let them exist there more. Not just like acting out, to, you know, let that be on the page too. And in The Universe Concealed, you know, I tried to make something that is a lively subject for me, a kind of interplay between a horror, grief and horror, and joking, part of the fabric of that story. I hope to do that a little more. There's some of that in the transplant essays. There are little macabre jokes, you know, about cannibalism, you know, and stuff like that. And I realized that they're not going to float me on Jay Leno. They still are probably more in the Dr. Phil realm, but they are my idea of jokes, and they're close to the way I do jokes. I also think probably, I don't know if this is true or not, but I've noticed, I've wondered, when I first started writing, and it was poetry in this case, but when I first started writing, men wrote in certain ways, you know, and I remember the first time I read Frank O'Hara, I thought, my God, you know, I'd never seen a man be giddy on the page before, you know. Men I had seen had been sort of, you know, august or thoughtful. I wonder sometimes how much of a kind of sense of seriousness derives from an early sense of, you know, what it is to be a man who writes, you know. Mm-hmm. I wonder and I worry, do I rule out certain kinds of campiness? Do I rule out certain kinds of giddiness a priori because they're not what a man writes, you know? They're not part of a public self, you know, they're behind the curtain. I wouldn't want to do that, you know, and so that's why I ask these questions.
Well, I wonder if it's also that the lyrical impulse, it doesn't admit as much humor, because I think that the best sort of humor, the best sort of funny writing is often bitter. It's angry.
Yeah.
It's coming from a different impulse, and it's not a lyrical impulse at all. You know, it's trying to do other work, and I think that might be it. I just thought of that. I don't know if that's true
because
or not.
I would think you might, because you're very funny in writing. You can do that, you know.
All right, I think I've got one more.
Not in person.
I've got one more question. In the poem in Ghost Letters St. Genet, you refer to the painful ascension toward the solitude of desire. I think in Mother of Sorrows and in Ghost Letters, it does seem like a lot of desire does lead to... It doesn't lead to connection. It does seem that it leads to... It seems like it does lead to solitude.
Yeah, it's sort of sad when I think about it. I think probably that's true in the work, that desire often is ultimately solitudinous, you know, even though it's enacted, people have sex or something like that, but desire is so often about a kind of inward dreaming, you know, as I imagine it in any case, you know, and maybe, it's funny because that line is actually from a poem called Saint Genet, you know, that's referencing Jean Genet, and probably... It's almost ridiculous to say. I feel like I've got his stamp all over me. I write about, you know, people living in a working class suburb in 1963. What could possibly be Jean Genet about carrying your lunchbox to Stephen Knowles Elementary School? But nonetheless, I feel strongly affected by him. And that sense, that dreamy sense, that desire is about longing. It's not about the connection to the actual object. You know, it's not about living in time. It's romance, not marriage. And that always is a more lonely enterprise, isn't it? That is, it's the dreamer dreaming, you know.
Certainly a more solitary enterprise.
More solitary, yes. You're right, that is part of, I think you said that, part of lyricism, you know, is almost the dreamer dreaming. I do think of desire that way. I have to say, I suspect that a lot of that has to do with growing up to sort of enter the social, psychological stage, you know, homosexual desire, you know, specifically. Is not to be enacted. No one grows up gay without some kind of, I think, marred and deformed sense. that things must be kept hidden, things that desire must be kept hidden, and it must be kept inward. And you learn very quickly. One of the first things you learn, if you feel homosexual desire, is never to express it, you know? And so I think it becomes a very inward kind of desire. It becomes fluted and ornamental. It becomes a kind of, it's a privation that you decorate with longing. It's not a privation that is going to be easily answered by being able to be enacted in social terms, at least not the way it was. And so, of course, who wants to look at this privation? It becomes a kind of beauty in itself, you know. So I think that it's necessarily connected to shame, that I think in homosexual desire, that the relation to shame, since to feel desire, you know, like as a young gay kid, is in fact to experience shame. And that those things become so conflated that they develop a terrific inwardness. And it's hard in those conditions to reach the object.
Well, and with that, I think that's a great answer. And I thank you for all of these eloquent answers to these very fumbling questions. I would like to encourage people to buy Mother of Sorrows. It's a very beautiful book. And to buy the Book of Poems as well, Ghost Letter. I was even more stunned by it, reading it again, than I was when I first read it. I think it's just a great book.
Thanks.
So thank you for talking with me. It's been great to see you.
Thanks, Wesley. It's really nice to see you.